Good evening and welcome to tonight's Monroe City Council meeting. This is the City Council meeting for May 9th, 2017. The time right now is 7 p.m. I've been on vacation for 2 weeks. Ms. Atkinson, will you please call the roll?
Certainly. Council members present and establishing a quorum are Scarborough, Cutaback, Rasmussen, Camp, and Hanford.
Thank you. And we heard at a previous meeting that Councilmember Hanford would not be here this evening, and we have not heard from Councilmember Davis as of yet. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so without objection, we'll consider Councilmember Hanford as excused, and we'll announce Councilmember Davis when he enters the chambers. Councilmember Rasmussen, will you please lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. First item that we have on the agenda this evening is the first item under presentations. This is a proclamation for Building Safety Month. Proclamation, Building Safety Month, May 2017. Whereas the City of Monroe's continuing efforts to address the critical issues of safety, energy, efficiency, and resilience is built in the built environment, which affect our citizens both in everyday life and in times of natural disaster, give us confidence that our structures are safe and sound. And whereas the city's confidence is achieved through the devotion of vigilant guardians, building safety and fire prevention officials, architects, engineers, builders, tradespeople, laborers, planners, and others in the construction industry who work year-round to ensure the safe construction of buildings. And whereas these guardians, dedicated members of the International Code Council, use a governmental consensus process that brings together local, state, and federal officials with expertise in the built environment to create and implement the highest quality codes to protect Americans and the buildings where we live, learn, work, worship, and play. And whereas the international codes, the most widely adopted building safety, energy, and fire prevention codes in the nation, are used by most U.S. cities, counties, and states, these modern building codes also include safeguards to protect the public from natural disasters such as hurricanes, snowstorms, tornadoes, wildland fires, and earthquakes. And whereas Building Safety Month is sponsored by the International Code Council to remind the public about the critical role of our community's largely unknown guardians of public safety, our local code officials, who assure us a safe, efficient, and livable buildings. And whereas Code Officials Partners in Community Safety and Economic Growth is the theme for Building Safety Month of 2017 and encourages all Americans to raise awareness of the importance of building safe and resilient construction, fire prevention, disaster mitigation, backyard safety, energy efficiency, and new technologies in the construction industry. Now, therefore, I, Jeffrey Thomas, do hereby proclaim the month of May 2017 as Building Safety Month and encourage our citizens to join with their communities in participation in Building Safety Month activities. Mr. Sherwood and also Ben and Mr. Swanson, please come forward and I'll present this proclamation to the two of you. Mr. Sherwood is our new building official. There you go. Do you now need to look at the camera? No, you weren't. You. That's good.
Particularly,
you're 1, 2, 3.
Thank you.
The next proclamation that we have to read in on the agenda is for Mother's Day. So this proclamation, whereas Mother's Day is dedicated to honor remarkable women who strive and sacrifice all year and inspire us to reach great heights and support us no matter the challenges we face or the paths we choose. And whereas we celebrate the women who raise us, who love us unconditionally, and who do whatever it takes to set us on the road to success and want nothing more for us than to lead happy, healthy lives. And whereas mothers are breadwinners, community leaders, and pillars of family, and through their example they teach the future dreamers and doers the value of hard work, compassion, service, and personal responsibility. And whereas mothers are owed our love and gratitude for the countless hours they contribute to working inside and outside the home and balancing a multitude of obligations, and whereas we give thanks to mothers who lift us up and offer us generous love and patient counsel and hold fast to all the memories in our hearts. Now, therefore, I, Jeffrey Thomas, do hereby recognize Sunday, May 14th, 2017, as Mother's Day and proclaim a happy Mother's Day, and encourage Monroe residents and businesses to honor and express love and gratitude to mothers everywhere. So there aren't enough proclamations to go around, but for all of you out there that are mothers, including Councilmember Cutaback here at the dais, thank you, and have a happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
And I'm going to say this because I can. Mom, happy Mother's Day. Okay. The next item that we have on our agenda is a presentation. This is Snohomish County Tourism Bureau, Miss Amy Spain and Tammy Dunn.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council Members. I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Council Members, for moving such a good line tonight. As you've already introduced, Tammy Dunn, who is our Sports Development Director, and Haley Lanham, another one of our staff members, is a sports sales manager. Both Tammy and Haley represent the Snohomish County Sports Commission, which is the sports division of the Snohomish County Tourism Bureau. Also with us tonight is Ethel Marzal. Ethel is a member of our board. She's a resident of Monroe, and her professional position is with Everett Mall. She's finishing the third year on the Snohomish County Tourism Bureau board. So thanks to Ethel for being here tonight as well. So with that, I'll just get started. The purpose of the Tourism Bureau is quite simply economic development through tourism. The industry earned over $1 billion of economic impact from visitor spending in 2016 and accounts for almost 11,000 jobs right here in Snohomish County. We have an old new partnership with Dave Summers being elected as county executive. One of the things that he did was realign some departments, and with that was the creation of the Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Department. So tourism was brought under the Parks and Recreation Department, and they are now our county liaison. We have always worked very closely with the Parks Department, specifically through our sports program, but other events as well. And so it's not really new, but it is a new framework with the tourism contract being managed through the Parks Department. The Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Department will be responsible for destination and product development. So you can think about infrastructure development, wayfinding signage, maybe addressing traffic issues, or maybe cell phone coverage in rural communities. So that kind of infrastructure. The Tourism Bureau will continue to promote, market, and provide industry education and visitor services, as we always have. So the Tourism Bureau grows economic development in our community through both internal and external strategies. And I should have noted the packets that you have is actually a longer presentation than what I'm going to go through tonight. So a little bit more information in your packets as well as a couple of our guides. So our internal strategies are about working within our community through industry education, providing marketing platforms for other businesses and communities to help further their dollar, providing sponsorship opportunities and referrals to businesses here, as well as the lead generation, both in sporting events, conventions, group travel, package tours, etc. The external strategies are the visitor focus. So that's where our website, our advertising, the production of our visitor guides, and some of which you have, our electronic newsletters to reach visitors and to let them know what's coming up so that they can plan their trip, and a very extensive social media platform. We are also, through our sports commission and sports sales function, we also have two other sales managers who bring in conventions, military reunions, weddings, all those kinds of more meeting-based programs and events. Our sales staff are proactive active in going on sales missions. They obviously are doing direct sales calls and belong to a number of membership organizations that give us that opportunity to have one-to-one communication with those Eventbrite organizers. This slide shows our relative funding in relationship to our other competitors. So here's our Snohomish County Tourism Bureau marketing fund. And we're sort of in the middle of the pack, quite a distance behind Tri-Cities, Pierce County, Yakima, Spokane, and Seattle Southside. Visit Seattle is not on this slide. That is a $23 million budget, so not on this slide at all. But we're sort of right in the middle of the pack. But I do want to point out that we are a very efficient organization. So this is our budget as compared to a percentage of economic impact. So our budget is the lowest as compared to the impact of tourism, meaning that we have the highest return on investment of any of our DMO, destination marketing organizations in the state. From a state level, visitors spent over $21 billion in 2016, accounted for nearly $2 billion in state and local taxes, and statewide, 177,000 plus people are directly employed by tourism businesses. We still do not have a state tourism program, and I won't take time to really discuss that today. I'll let you know that there is both a House and Senate bill that both have included very minimal funding to just keep it in the conversation as they go through the budget discussion. And I would urge you to reach out to your representatives and senators in order to support tourism going forward. This continues to be the David and Goliath situation that we find ourselves in, and in fact, we have $0 for Washington State. So the funding that we did have in the biennium budget previously has been removed. So the only funding that we have to help keep tourism alive is basically keeping the website open, and that's really about it. So we really need a state tourism program, and would encourage your support for that. Overnight travelers to Snohomish County spend $366 per travel party per day, so that's kind of a snapshot of who's coming into our community. The Tourism Bureau and Sports Commission focuses on events that drive overnight stays, and this is the reason. This is the impact of a day traveler versus an overnight traveler. And it's not just about hotels, and I've got a slide to address that in a minute, but obviously that traveler is staying 2.1 nights. They're not only with the hotels, but they have more meals and more attractions, they're shopping, they're participating in all kinds of events, they're buying gas or buying groceries, and so their spend is more. So we try to focus on those programs that bring overnight travelers. It doesn't mean day travelers aren't important. For all of our communities who have festivals and events that people who are in Seattle come up for, you don't care if they're staying overnight, maybe if they're at that festival, but the impact is greater for the overnight travelers, so that's where we spend most of our time and resources. This is a little diagram showing that, where the travelers are coming in through all different kinds of modes of transportation, and they're spending all of those dollars at museums, at parks, at restaurants, at shops, etc. And what they spend, that leaves the tax dollars in our communities as well as employing our residents. So that's the value of tourism. Visitors spent $1.4 billion, which was up 2.8% over the previous year. And to my earlier point about accommodations being third on the list, so restaurants actually receive a larger portion of the visitor dollars than do hotels. But even grocery stores receive a portion of that visitor dollar. In addition to the jobs, which I already mentioned, the payroll for our residents, visitor spending also leaves almost $22 million right here in Snohomish County. So every one of us, whether you're involved in tourism or not, that's an important figure. So $22 million that you and I don't have to spend for our city and county government and the services that are provided from our taxes. I'm not going to go into detail on these bullet points. Again, in your packets, you've got some more information on this. but really to talk a little bit about the tourism spend, as I said, over $1 billion in 2016. At first glance, the hotel occupancy, average rate, and RevPAR is pretty flat, up a little bit here, down a little bit there. But that's really not as bad a picture, maybe, as at first looks, because we had four hotels open in 2015. So the fact that the hotels were able to maintain their occupancy and rates, even with that influx of new supply, is a pretty strong indicator. And the hotel motel tax collections were up 2.8% over the previous year. So now I'm going to talk a bit about the group sales process, both the sporting events and the convention and our other conventions and sales managers. So this yellow line here is the combined tentative indefinite. So at year end, December 31st, in each of those years, is a snapshot of the amount of business that either had confirmed definite or was still tentative on the books, meaning they hadn't made their decision whether they were coming. And you see the nice trend going upwards each over time. Another way of looking at that same information is from the economic impact. These plateaus where we jumped was actually as a result of increasing our sales staff. We've been very blessed to receive some funding from the Tourism Promotion Area Fund, which is a lodging assessment, and with that we've been able to add sales staff, and you can see the direct result of that work. Our sports sales staff, and I say this not just because Haley and Tammy are here with me today, but our sports sales department rocks. They are responsible for over $35 million of the $58 million that we brought in and are able to track, over $35 million of economic impact from the sports programs that are brought into the county as a result of the work of our awesome staff. And that's just what we're able to track. We know that there is more, both in leisure and group sales, there is more activity, more hotel room nights, more economic impact, so we know that these numbers are very conservative. And from the events that we were able to track, we know that the city of Monroe had an economic impact of over $19 million and over 14,000 room nights associated with sporting events and group tours and meetings that our sales staff were able to bring into the community. We have a very robust visitor services program. We have visitor information centers that we manage in South County in Heritage Park, which is right at the I-5 and 405 juncture in Linwood. We operate a visitor information center in the city of Snohomish at Highway 9 and Highway 2, sort of at that juncture in historic downtown Snohomish, and also at the Future of Flight and Boeing Tour. Additionally, our visitor services staff helps to train visitor information centers that operate, train and support visitor information centers that are operated by your local chambers or cities. So our partners here with the Monroe Chamber, we provide valuable training, collateral materials, support, marketing platforms for them to work collaboratively with us. We are also digital. We have a number of kiosks, electronic kiosks, one at the Linwood Convention Center, one at the Future of Flight and Boeing Tour, and one and two at the Tulalip Resort. So this is an online iPad that people can go and find information on their own, so we don't have to have a visitor information staff there to answer those questions. We're also mobile. We go to a number of festivals and events, and those change every year, which ones we attend so that we can try to help festivals and events throughout the county. In addition to these, we were also at the Evergreen State Fair last fall as well. So, in a nutshell, the results of our sales program were able to generate nearly $59 million of economic impact that we were able to track. The tourism spending of $1.04 billion was through the Dean Runyon Associates. That's an annual report that we've been getting for decades. There was a new study that was done and published in 2015, and there was a Blue Ribbon Task Force that the governor created, and they did an outdoor recreation study. And that study, they all used a little bit different formulas and different touch points to gather their information, but that study indicated that there was over $2 billion of economic impact in Snohomish County as a result of outdoor recreation. So no matter how you slice it, outdoor recreation and tourism in Snohomish County and to the city of Monroe is significant. So I'll close my presentation and open it up for questions with just reminding you that tourism is economic development. It does employ residents of your community, and the visitor spend leaves almost $22 million right here in Snohomish County to help support the infrastructure for our cities and counties. So with that, I'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Before we begin on questions, let the record show that Councilmember Davis entered chambers at 7:14. Are there any questions or comments from council? Okay.
Right.
Councilmember Gamble.
Don, appreciate the presentation very much. You know, one question I did have is that, you know, for the sports programs, I'm sure there's a lot of partnerships between city parks.
Absolutely.
And then is there also partnerships with the school districts with some of the...
Yeah, and Tammy, I'll ask you to come up and address that, but very much so. We work with public and private facilities to bring in events, but Tammy can speak specifically to that.
I feel that we have a great partnership with the Monroe School District, with the new fields that the high school has. I do know that in partnership with the school district, and I want to say the city of Monroe, they did apply for a tourism promotion area grant to help with at least one field and kind of kick off some sessions with being able to get that bonded. And we have been part of their discussions with facility use and knowledge of that. So I have a better relationship with John Mannix, as well as the young lady from facility scheduling, even working with them and trying to find additional parking for Spartan Race, which happened a couple of weeks ago. And having that connection really helps. So now we have a better partnership. The school district also has fabulous facilities that we can promote.
There's two more coming online. I'm not sure if you're aware.
Yeah, I am. I know Park Place is adding, and you know, I take a look at City of Monroe as a whole, particularly for baseball fields, softball fields. Take Sky River, take Miracle Field, you take Lake Tide, take the high school, you take Park Place. So in one city, you have 10 fields. And I would say, well, it may not be 10 fields in one location, but it's 10 fields in one city. And where else can you find that in the Pacific Northwest? So that's kind of my way of saying we have a great partnership. And I believe with the partnership that we have with the Parks Department, helped us with the school district facilitating that so that we're a better partner moving forward.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. I just wanted to acknowledge Tammy and Haley. I've had the privilege of working with them the last couple of years on the Troy Monroe event, and that's just been an awesome partnership and make it very easy and very, very supportive of the events. And this is a huge event that comes, I think it's in its seventh year coming to Monroe, and it's bringing athletes, coaches, families from across the country and really the world. So I really do appreciate the work that you guys bring here.
Thank you. Councilmember Cutterback.
So I had a resident ask me about where Amtrak stopped, and I think, I don't know if it was a long, long time ago, the Amtrak used to stop in Monroe somewhere. I don't know if you have any influence or thought on how that's determined.
I don't recall there being a stop in Monroe. And
I think it was, I was told it was a long, long
decade. Yeah, probably a long, long time.
Yeah, it's been a couple of decades at least, yeah. And that's, you know, Amtrak makes their determination based on ridership and those kinds of things. So I will say that we do work with Amtrak. They do market the, so there's the Coast Starlight that goes all the way down the West Coast, but then there's the Cascade, which is from, and I'm forgetting the city in Oregon, Ashland, I want to say, but anyway, somewhere in sort of the southern half of Oregon, all the way up to Vancouver, BC. And we have three Amtrak stops along that I-5 route in Edmonds, Everett, and Stanwood. And so we work with Amtrak to help package and promote those cities and those stops. We work with the hotels to have them provide transportation from Amtrak to their properties to encourage that. I just was working with a travel writer who's doing both a book about non-motorized travel and an article for OnTrack magazine about about those communities and what do you do if you arrive without a motor vehicle and how do you get around and what attractions and are within walking distance and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, I've taken both of those that you mentioned and they're just beautiful. And I had just a resident wonder, wouldn't it be great if we had a stop in Monroe? Would that help? What would that bring? What would that look like? And on the way east.
Right, right. Well, with the stop in Everett
so close,
yeah. I don't know how Amtrak would look at there, and I'm not able to speak to this, but there's been sweeping changes in the federal funding for Amtrak, and the partnership between the state and federal, so the state now is responsible for the tracks within Washington State. It's no longer a federally supported program, so they're not at a juncture right now where they would be likely looking to add stops, but I certainly can't speak to their business model.
And then one other question, just about the fair. And the fair, it doesn't seem as connected to Monroe as far as, it doesn't feel that way. We host it here, but I'm not sure how much people that go to the fair come and visit and do other things in Monroe. And has there ever been any talk of the fair in Snohomish County promoting like a two-day pass at the fair, stay over, don't hassle with the drive, explore Monroe, come to the fair 2 days. Any discussion
about that? The fair does generate, all your hotels are full at that time.
Okay.
So whether they're vendors or visitors, horsemen, people are coming to the concerts, what have you, your hotels are full during the fair days. And so those people who are staying there obviously then are going to your restaurants and your shops and other things outside of the fairground. We do work closely, but even more so, as I was mentioning, this new partnership with the tourism now being under the Parks, Recreation, and Expanded Tourism Department. We're having conversations with Tom Tigan, who is the park director, currently about how can we better align and better communicate with their team so that we're, I don't want to make it sound like we operated in complete silos before, but obviously there's always room for improvement in how we can better communicate and package and utilizing the same social media messaging so that we're expanding that reach and that message for whatever the fairgrounds is doing, that we're also in tandem with that. So look to more partnerships, certainly, in the future.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
Anything further from Council? Amy and Tammy, thank you both very much. I know that we have a lot of events that come here. I think the Fast Pitch Softball?
National Softball Association Fast Pitch, which is here like 2015.
Yeah, I know that came here because of the work that the Sports Commission is doing, and there have been other events here too. So I appreciate the work that you do, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Councilor Cutaback, we had bets over here that that Brad probably knew when the train station last operated. I did a quick Google over here. Apparently, there's some website that says you can right now take a train from Everett to Monroe for as low as $14, and the stop is a Shell station on Highway 2. So I've never seen a train stop here, but there you go. Yes, Councilor Kim.
That is part of the Amtrak bus thing. Is shut you.
Oh, an Amtrak bus? Okay.
I saw something like that.
Well, bus makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. Yes.
All right, so the next item we have on the agenda this evening is comments from citizens. This is a time set aside for members of the audience to speak to the City Council on any issue related to the City of Monroe, except in a quasi-judicial matter that is subject to a public hearing. There is a sign-in sheet, and there is nobody that has signed in. Is there anybody in the public who would like to come forward to speak to the City Council? Anybody at all? Insert Jeopardy music here. All right, we're going to go ahead and move on to the consent agenda. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Consent agenda.
Okay, so I have a motion.
Second.
I have a motion to approve the minutes and payroll warrants, and I have a second from Councilmember Gamble. So again, this is a motion to approve the consent agenda. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion passes 6-0. Thank you. Next item on the agenda is new business. This is item number 1, AB 17078, ordinance number 011-2017, amending decision regulations code. First reading. I was going to call you Councilmember Swanson. Mr. Swanson.
Thank you. Thank you, Council Mayor. So the proposal you have in front of you would amend the decision-making process. And what I mean by that is every land use action or permit that's issued goes through a decision-making process that identifies either the approving body and more than likely the recommending, approving, and appeal and body that the permit would be appealed to. And so in this case, it was started, I look back through the notes, approximately a year and a half ago, city staff started working on this. And just recently went through Planning Commission for review and with a recommendation of approval in February. And probably the biggest change that this would put forth is right now under preliminary plats, the hearing examiner holds the public hearing, takes testimony, and makes recommendation to council for final approval. That would remove council from that process, and it would stop at the hearing examiner, and any appeals from there would essentially go to Superior Court. You'll also notice in here that the appeal body, many of the sections, it's towards the last of the page in the matrix, you'll see it's been shifted from City Council to Superior Court. Looking back to the notes and just from what I know about it, it looks like staff originally started this for a couple reasons, to help streamline the permit process and also from a risk management aspect. And so just to give you a little history on the hearing examiner system, is for years and years when Code Cities initially started, they had the planning commission and you had a council. And that's where your land use process went through, whether it was a legislative or a quasi-judicial. And so planning commission started it and then city council would approve it. So then the state came up with this hearing examiner option that cities can incorporate a hearing examiner. And that became popular for a couple different reasons. Is it pulled the council and the planning commission kind of out of some of these heavily contested quasi-judicial matters, where in quasi-judicial versus legislative, you're looking at the criteria. Does it meet this, 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 and this? If it meets those criteria, then we recommend approval. It's not based on any personal feeling, whereas a legislative action is what reflects the community. How do we feel about this when we're creating comp plans, things like that, which allows a much broader path to take. Quasi-judicial, you're strapped in, and if we go in front of a hearing examiner, and the same, and this applies all the way up the chain, if we want to recommend denial, we better have a very good reason why we're recommending denial for that permit, whether they're not, where we have to cite and show they're not meeting a code requirement. And the second part is the city's insurance and county's insurance started pushing them towards the hearing examiner system, asking them to go to it because they were dealing with a lot of lawsuits where these complicated legal issues, and typically it wasn't that the officials were doing anything like they had an ulterior motive, they just didn't know about the process very well. And so they were making decisions that basically either went against their own code or went against state law. They would get sued, they'd go to court, and then the insurance authority would have to pay out for those mistakes. One of the classic ones is a hotly contested plat, preliminary plat that comes in, and staff recommends approval, or the hearing examiner in this case recommends approval, meets all the requirements, but you have a room full of 50 people that just don't want this plat to go in. They're used to that being the green space, that's where their kids play, and I can imagine this is, you know, it's very difficult to sit up there and have all these citizens, the people you're representing, saying, we don't absolutely want this, and then you have to turn around and say, well, it meets the requirements, it's approved. And so, again, it pulls the council and past planning commission out of that area. And so just reviewing these, you know, staff's intent, and then just from my experience, it does typically go just to a hearing examiner. And it looks like when Monroe adopted the hearing examiner option, that they kind of created a hybrid. And so they kept our hearing examiner, but kept counsel in there also for that final decision. And so in this case, when you have the applicant who goes for a preliminary plat, they go to the hearing examiner. He has approximately 2 weeks for Monroe to render a decision, to issue his decision. And sometimes they're, you know, 3 days and you got a decision. Sometimes they take the 2 weeks, just depending on how busy they are. So when we're waiting to schedule that council meeting, we're holding off for that decision. Sometimes, from what I understood in the past, is they've kind of gambled and just said, hey, we'll go for it and hopefully we'll have the decision by then. It doesn't make the hearing packet. It just gets sloppy. And so with this process of going for hearing examiner, waiting for their decision, getting the decision, scheduling it for council, we have to have a week ahead of time so we can get everything in the packet. Sometimes you add on between 2 and 3 weeks to the process before that applicant gets that preliminary plat approval. And so they're typically gunning for that preliminary plat approval because they want to turn their civil drawings and get those reviews so they can start turning dirt. And a lot of the times it just lines up with the construction window where they're trying to get in and get things done during the dry season, you know, during the summer months. And so that's for the streamline process. And then I went over kind of the risk management process.
Okay, so we have a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. Councilmember Gamble.
I have a motion. Move to accept as first reading ordinance number 011-2017, amending Monroe Municipal Code Title 14, Floodplain Regulations Title 17, Subdivisions Title 18, Planning and Zoning Title 21, Development Review Procedures, updating, streamlining, and clarifying the city's land use permit processing regulations to reflect the city's intent and modern practices, eliminating obsolete and redundant land use approval procedures and requirements, providing for severability, and establishing an effective date.
Second.
I have a motion from Councilmember Gamble, a second from Councilmember Rasmussen for the requested action as identified in agenda number 17-078 in the agenda.
Yeah.
You still have the floor?
Yep. Nope. I think this is a good idea. I like the concept of, you know, kind of,
yeah.
You know, I've seen it happen before where, you know, almost politics gets involved in a review of an approval. So I think this is long overdue. So thanks for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. Explain to me again, so the Planning Commission will not be involved in this, or will be involved?
They currently are. They've been out of the process for quite some time with regard to the quasi-judicial, and that's what this impacts. You know, when we go through the comp plan process, code amendments, the legislative actions that impact everyone, Planning Commission is still involved. None of that's changed. And so what this largely impacts is at the council level, where it still retained this, go through preliminary plat recommendation from the hearing examiner, hits council makes the final decision, and in the appeal process with going to Superior Court.
So it goes right through the hearing examiner first, right? And after that has occurred, then it goes directly into the legal process. The council bypass, we don't have the issues. I've seen it before where we have someone has a particular issue, I think there's like a hobby park thing we had.
A what?
A hobby park issue. This is before I was on council, but I was sitting in the audience listening to it.
Okay.
So, yeah. And that's okay. That was quite a
good okay. Time.
But anyway, the point was, it was the requirements in the code allow whatever development or whatever issue to happen, but the fact that it was just someone's hobby farm, the council reviewed it and said, no, we're just going to leave it as is.
Okay.
So that decision would be made by the hearing examiner.
So do you remember what kind of land use action that was?
I can't remember the part, but I'm just trying to picture. So you've got the hearing examiner who's going to do the review.
Oh, Brad probably.
I was on council.
You were on the
Becker thing.
Ben was here.
The Becker.
Yeah. Yes, Ben was here.
I do remember
because
that.
He remembered that.
Wow. I put that on my mind, but I do remember it.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but I was on council when that happened, and I sided with the city staff at that time.
Right. Oh, wait, so that's why you remember. Okay. That's the only concern I had is council stepped in with a human approach, basically, and said, well, it meets all the criteria. I think Councilmember Williams said that he had an uncle or somebody who just had like a little piece of dirt that he liked to go out and play with his tractor, and was about it. So is that kind of that human aspect kind of going away with this?
Well, that was, that kind of fell out into an unusual thing where it was more of like a code enforcement issue, so it wasn't a land use action. I would have to go back and look at the code enforcement chapter.
That's fine.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It, so, no, with this amendment, it would be, you'd be going through the criteria of the code, basically, that's set by council when you're going through and reviewing the preliminary plats. And just like with the code, you know, that's what we as staff go by, and then we go to the hearing examiner. If you've never been in front of a hearing examiner, it's quite a process because you're both up there and both your feet are held to the fire if you're the applicant or staff. Okay. And so he makes sure that we're not overreaching any ask from our end because, you know, we do require mitigation for certain things. We do require that under Safe Routes to School, the sidewalks be supplied, you know, so kids can get out. But there's also a thing that we deal with called nexus and proportionality, where if someone's putting in a development, we can't have them go clear across town to replace a section of sidewalk because that has nothing to do with their impact. Okay. And so the hearing examiner is there to ensure that we're meeting those guidelines. He doesn't just look at the applicant that's proposing the plat. He's ensuring that staff's conditions of approval and analysis is consistent with both local and state law.
No, but I agree that this is probably long overdue. That we really need to get out of this course, especially the example you have of the 50 people in the audience telling us one thing. So I support it. I just want to make sure that, like I said, the example of humanity that came into that one issue always struck me as the council making what I thought was the right decision at the time. So anyway, that was it. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Any other questions or comments? Any other discussion? Councilmember Cutterback.
So Ben, can you kind of walk me through how this, if this was in place at the time, how this would affect it, kind of how we handled East Monroe or the...
The East Monroe, that was a... Was it Compline
Amendment?
Compline Rezone. So under a comprehensive plan amendment, it still would have went through...
through the same process.
Planning Commission and City Council.
Correct.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Which, I... So would the growth management board be included after the hearing examiner as part of the appeals process?
Well, that one under that it would have went through planning commission, council, and then growth management hearing board.
Oh, so
and
that's still a little bit.
Yeah. So hearing examiners don't do legislative. They only do the quasi judicial.
Okay.
Councilor Cutback, did you have anything further?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
All right, sure. So is there any other discussion, any other deliberation? Okay, seeing none, again, the motion is as identified in the agenda bill. This is essentially to accept as first reading. I'm going to go ahead and call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed. Motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much, everybody. And please extend a thank you to the Planning Commission for their work and review of this also.
Absolutely.
All right, the next item that we have on our agenda is also under new business. This is new business item number 2, AB 17079, discussion, repeal, replace, city development regulations. Mr. Swanson.
Thank you. So this was a little more unusual. I'm just asking for feedback at this point, and what this is regarding is our large code amendment that we have coming up. We're essentially going to start from scratch. We'll save, you know, recent updates that were done to code. We'll obviously keep those, but a lot of retooling of the code and reestablishing and consolidating everything down under one title. It's spread between, I don't know, 4 or 5 titles right now. Not easy to find, and so in this process, we're modeling what a lot of other jurisdictions that they've already done it. And so we'll even be pulling some of Public Works code in with it. And so we're hoping for a one-stop shop for people when they go through, so they're not, you know, going, oh, you need to go up here to this title and pull it back. So before we start down this road, I went to Planning Commission and asked some real, real high level questions. And this is going to be a difficult one to answer and give feedback on because it wants to pull you down into the document, pull you under the weeds. But right now we just want some high level feedback. So when we move forward with the code, we have some direction on how we're going with it. And so I picked out some things that are typically, one of those more of a process, but very unique to each jurisdiction on how they like to handle it. And there's nothing saying that, you have to go this way or don't have to go this way. It's strictly up to each city on how they want to move forward. So one of the first ones is, and unfortunately this was just the thing that we did the first reading on, is we would be essentially, it would say the same thing, but it would be in a much easier format. And so we'd go to a permit typing system. And what that does is that essentially it puts every single land use permit in a category, and you can go 1 through 4, 1 through 5, and it makes it easy for the applicant because they can come in and they can say, you know what, I want to do a boundary line adjustment. I see that's a type 1. I didn't include everything in here just to not overwhelm you. But then you'd have an associated matrix below that says type 1 permit, this is what you do. So, okay, you know, basically it's a director decision on this one. The appeal goes to the hearing examiner. And so it's just, I've used this form before. For some reason, Monroe, even way back when I worked with a past director, that he was content with the code the way it was and didn't want to go to this typing system. Other jurisdictions that I worked in have done the permit typing, and it's just easier. It's easier for staff to use, and it's easier for applicants to come in, because it's just a series of matrix that show you how you do it, and it's all on one page. It's not scattered from one chapter to another chapter, and there's not a lot of text that's involved in it. There are a few points of clarification in there where you have to, you know, get down in the weeds a little bit, but it's a nice, easy tool, and so that's why one of the big things I'm proposing to move to is this typing system.
And before we call on council members, just to give you a little bit of context here, I did the typing system at the city of Redmond. We adopted it when I was a planner there in roughly 2002. So this is something that's been in use at least for 15 years in the city of Redmond, and it made things so much simpler. And when it came time to revise the code, if you needed to revise the notice procedures for conditional use permits, rather than having to revise the procedures for conditional use permits, shoreline conditional use permits, etc., you just revised them for type 3. And it made things so much simpler, both for editing and also for implementation. So I'm going to strongly recommend that, yes, we replace the existing permitting system with this. And are you going to identify what the Planning Commission recommended as part of this?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, so at Planning Commission...
Oh, there it is. Sorry.
Oh. Yeah, so if you didn't see it on each one, it also has the Planning Commission direction to staff. So they wanted to move forward with that permit typing system under the new code. And again, this isn't all written in stone. As we go through this process, if we find something that doesn't work, and I do want to have periodic check-ins with City Council through this, just to make sure we're on the same page and not going down the wrong path.
Yeah, and lastly, this is so that we can establish a scope of work, so that when we go out with the RFP, we don't say that we want apples and we find out that you wanted bananas or carrots. Councilmember Cutterback.
This makes complete sense to me, to simplify and put it in the type 1 through 4, or if we go 5, whatever that is, and makes it easier, and then have down below or extended exactly what you have to do to get that. Will it also include in that same document what the price is and how long it takes, the timing? Is that inclusive in this document?
No, it's not. Prices are all set out in the fees resolution,
yeah.
And so that's just all that one document. Which part?
No, I did not. I know it's in there, but you were saying everything's going to be kind of in one.
Yeah, so the price, because the fees are by resolution and this one will be by ordinance, so anytime we'd want to make a tweak with the fees resolution, it's really nice because you do have that, even though it's a separate document, when somebody comes in and says, you know, hey, I want to construct a new home and some other things, you can just hand that fees resolution and either staff or through it just kind of highlights this is what's going to apply to you. So I would recommend again separating that fees resolution out into this section. And timing is always a difficult one, because I get that question a lot when somebody comes in and says, you know, hey, I want to submit a preliminary plat. How long does it take to approve?
Yeah.
And it all depends on the quality of the application. I mean, 100% depends on the quality of the application. We're working with a group right now, and they came in with, beyond a great application. I mean, they went through an indent, they gave the narrative, they identified everything. That was the consultant. The applicant was very timely with their response, and we got that thing done, and this was for a large preliminary plat, probably done in a month and a half. And I've done, 20 lot plats that have taken 6 months just because you are trying to draw information out or you're responding back to the applicant, and they'll sit on it for months and not get back to you because they get busy with something else. And so timelines are just a bear to get down and identify. We do have our regulatory timelines, which are set. And so for preliminary plats, it's 90 days. And it's basically called the clock. And so the clock stops once you get your comments back to the applicant, so that 90-day period. So if I have it for 15 days, I give it back to the applicant. They take, 90 days and give it back to me. I'm still at 15 days for the clock. So we still have that set by state law. But yeah, timelines, it's always been a really difficult one.
All right. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. So is there a common value or variable with each one of these types? I want to say common theme, but that's
No, you're right on with that. So the type ones are typically the admin approvals. It would be something that I would approve, like a boundary line adjustment.
Right.
And so they come in, and those are the much simpler ones. Short plats fall into those areas, vacations or alterations. So, and then you get into the type twos, which you're typically getting into a hearing examiner realm.
Okay. And that's all. I just wanted to know that there was.
There is.
So that if a new thing comes up or something wasn't anticipated, it would have something in common with one of these types that you would know which one.
You're exactly right. That's a great point. Okay. So, yeah.
This sounds like a good idea.
Okay. Thank you. We'll go on to number two.
So planned residential developments. This is one of those things, and just like in any profession or any area, you have your fads and your popular things that come in and then slowly fade out. So PRDs is one of those things that came in pretty heavy in the 90s, had been around for a while, and then slowly started to fade out. Some jurisdictions still have them. They're not totally gone. But one thing I noticed planned residential development. So when I first started it, I noticed something that every single subdivision was a PRD. And so instead of being the exception, now they're now the norm. And so that was a little unusual because typically PRDs, you set these really kind of additional high levels that only people that really want to make those areas come in. And so you'll have, a few plats and maybe one PRD. And so it was kind of scattered across the board. So when I came in, I thought that was a little unusual to have that. And so instead of having this exception now it's the norm, I thought, well, why don't we just get rid of PRDs and just kind of go to a gross lot area and just make things very simple, I'm kind of skipping ahead here, but some of the requirements by PRDs or design guidelines and open space, give them the density that they want, and then just require some design guidelines and open space if the council and planning commission still desire something like that. That way we're not going through these bonuses, and in some places it still has a PRD going through and taking out a percentage for infrastructure, and then you add another 30% to the bonus. And it got so confusing in cases. We had some past planners actually quote the wrong number of lots to applicants, and then we have applicants coming in anticipating a certain number of lots that in reality isn't what they can generate off that PRD. It just made things very confusing. The PRD code, I reviewed that several times. It actually passed when I was here last time. I wasn't a big fan of it then, and now it's not very user-friendly. And so when I was talking with Planning Commission, it was one of those things where if you want to go down this path, and what a lot of jurisdictions kind of realize is, why don't we just give them a set density at a gross acreage and then just say, we want these design guidelines and we want, for example, an open space requirement too. And so they just made it very clear. And another thing that the PRD does with the 30% bonus is, so we've adopted the new comprehensive plan and the associated map. And in the low density zoning area, just as an example, the comp plan accounts for between 3 and 5 units per acre. And so that's what our comp plan establishes. So when we do our zoning, there's that room to play with. You can go down to 3 units or you can go up to 5 units per acre with that zoning. If you decide to go at 4 units per acre and you're giving them that 30% bonus, well, now you're developing out beyond what your comp plan designation was at a 5.2 5.2 units per acre, so now you're exceeding it, and then if you want to go up to 5 units per acre, if that's what, you know, Planning Commission comes through and recommends, now you're really exceeding your established levels under your comprehensive plan. So it makes things difficult for our buildable lands also, you know, and for our projections. And so what we're proposing is, let's just make it easy, and if we decide to go with an R4, just say you get 4 units per acre. And so if half that acre is wetland, then you just have smaller lots, but you still get 4 units. The kind of the big asterisk to this is, if the entire land's covered by a critical area, then you go through a reasonable use permit and essentially get, you know, 1 unit on that lot. So there are some subtleties, but the thing that I really want to gear towards is gross. Just when they come in, you know, and they put out the acres, this is how many units you get. We're not adding anything, we're not multiplying, or we're not taking away from anything. This is just kind of a flat allowance. And then just kind of move forward from there. And so it's hard to talk about that without, you know, diving into some of the other things, but do you have any questions on that? I've worked in jurisdictions that have done the gross calculation. I much prefer it over the net. Net, you start taking out, you know, roads, impacts usually around 20% for your, you know, road impacts in your unbuildable area. Developers will know. They'll go in there, they'll do their studies, they'll know how many units they can get out of there. If you just give them a net, you don't have to take out the roads for them.
Okay, so we've got two questions then, and the first one being 2A, should the city eliminate the planned residential development PRD regulations? Planning Commission's recommendation was that the city should. Staff's recommendation is the same, that there are other tools in the toolbox today, and that PRDs, I know at the county, have become more of the, or at least I believe that at the county it's become more of the norm also. And again, there are other tools to achieve the diversity of housing mix and reduce side yard setbacks and whatnot that are used today. So, Council, do you want to accept Planning Commission's recommendation on 2A, and then we'll move on to 2B? Is there any? Okay, so I'm hearing a consensus for yes, the city should eliminate the PRD regulations, understanding that there are other things that we can do to achieve densities and whatnot.
Perfect.
We'll go ahead and move on to 2B. So the staff question is, to simplify land development process, should a gross land area calculation be used to determine residential development allowances in low and medium density zones in accordance with the current comp plan? The Planning Commission recommendation was to use the gross land area. From my experience, having worked as a developer in Snohomish County and then also having worked as a planner for the city of Redmond, it was a lot easier to just use the gross. So if you've got 1 acre and you are allowed to have 4 dwelling units, you got 4 dwelling units in that acre, and just like our staff pointed out, if half of it is wetland, then there are other tools in the toolbox that allowed you to do things like cluster developments and what they're calling planned residential developments and things like that. So rather than doing a standard subdivision and something different, it also made it easier when I was talking to people who would contact me over the counter, say, how many units, how many houses can go on that property next door to us? I could easily say, well, it's 1 acre, so they could get 4 on that because it's R4. It's 4 dwelling units per acre. So I for one, would recommend the staff and also the Planning Commission recommendation on that. Does Council concur with the direction of the Planning Commission? Is there any objection to that?
Just talking about what
we're
explaining that.
Exactly.
Okay, yes.
Okay, any objection to proceeding that way with the scope? All right, I see none, so we'll go ahead and move on to 3.
All right, great. So development agreements, I'll be real quick on this. State law allows cities to enter into development agreements. I would like to develop a chapter around this. I've done it in other jurisdictions, and just like with state law, they give you a few minimum requirements. This would essentially spell out the process a little bit more. Development agreements are great because an applicant can come in and ask for additional vesting on their vesting time on their plat or short plat that they've done. Typically it's a plat. They can propose phasing in those development agreements. Essentially, that kind of pulls you out of that real rigid area you're in and allows allows for more of a free negotiation. You can't bend your code rules with it, but it allows for, if an applicant comes and says, you know, hey, I have this big development, I want to develop it in four phases, they come and that's an ask from the city. Well, then that opens up the city that says, well, hey, you know, if we're going to give you a little leeway here, you know, maybe we get a little more, you know, open space out of this, or push things around. It allows for negotiations between the city and developer for, you know, providing some consensus on things. One area that I worked in, it was a very complicated process. It involved a nonprofit wanting to take over a chunk of land, a developer that wanted to build around the chunk of land, and then the city, you know, sort of.
Was there a barn involved?
There was a barn involved.
Okay.
And so what the development agreement allowed is the city gave certain concessions to the developer as far as phasing, and then extending out time periods, and then in turn for the developer getting that, they are actually giving a chunk of land to this, or significantly reducing the price on this chunk of land to this nonprofit that was involved, and then set aside a huge tract of open space in this other area. All of this was much more complicated than that, but this development agreement allowed us to develop this framework and then essentially set the expectations of all parties involved and then move forward with the project. And so on this one, like I said, it's already in state law. We could, if an applicant came in and if council wished, we could enter in one today, but this just provides a little more framework on what's expected and how we go about it. So pretty simple thing.
Okay. So questions or direction, Councilmember Kim?
Yes, I'm sorry, but I'm having a hard time following this. So, and I think I've got a few questions. Can I get, before we, how, is there a time limit on when we have to decide on this item? I'd like a little bit more information.
Oh, I'm going to decide. This is just high level stuff. I mean, we can, again, we'll have some workshops in between. This DA, or the development agreement allowance, like I said, is allowed by the state right now.
Right. Okay. It's just things will pop into my head. Who does the negotiating? Who determines what's an equitable transfer or exchange between the developer and the city?
Good question. So staff would do a lot of legwork, but council would approve it. So staff could, for example, I went through one where it was a lot of negotiation and various things that got to council. Council decided they didn't like a few things, so reopened negotiations, got it hashed out there at council, and they signed it off. And so it doesn't ultimately say, you know, when staff brings it, it doesn't mean everything stopped. I made sure that everybody knew up front that this is not my decision. This is a council decision. Mm-hmm. And so you're essentially negotiating, you know, on behalf of the city, just like you would, you know, anything else. But it's not my approval, it's council's approval. And so on the complicated ones, we would actually bring it to council kind of halfway through the development agreement process. A lot of times, they'll be very simple things. Someone will want to phase their development just because they have a lot of lots that they need to go through and don't want to put out all those funds to install all that infrastructure, and so now they have millions of dollars of infrastructure waiting there until they can get all those houses built. And so for phasing, they'll say, well, I want to do, like, you know, 50% of it. So now they're only putting out that upfront money for that 50% infrastructure. They build the majority of their houses up, then they install that additional infrastructure. So under our code, when in most every other jurisdiction's code for planning a property, you go through preliminary plat, then you receive your construction drawing approval, and that's when they start putting in their infrastructure work. And then once it's done, they go to final plat. Well, we can't just say, oh, you know, only put half of it in, you're fine, and we'll catch up with you later on that. That's just not the way the process works. So with these development agreements, this would allow some additional leeway. I don't mean to make it sound like, you know, we automatically start asking the developer for things. This just sets out an established expectations and criteria of what we expect out of them if they're granted this additional either time frame or phasing allowance.
Okay, but before we go forward with this, we're going to have more detail.
Okay.
A lot. For final approval for council, so yeah, I'd be willing to wait for that.
Okay,
but it sounds like it could be a good direction. Like I said, I just have a couple of concerns and clarifications.
And that's all we're looking for at this point. And that's great. So, you know, if it sounds like something we should, you know, pursue, we'll pursue.
Okay.
Yeah, and just to clarify, this is just
between the.
We have the ability to under state law, is what I understand. But just to clarify, Councilmember Camp, what we're doing here is we're just developing a scope of work, and it's one of those things that the consultant that we hire could go ahead and put something in there. We could take a look at it, say we want this or we want that added to it, and then at the end of the day, you could just strike it from the ordinance or you could adopt it. So there will be a lot more conversation on it.
That's fine.
Yeah. And I'll get to Councilmember Cutterback in just a second. My background in doing development agreements was that it caused complexity for planners, so that they used to call them concomitant agreements, I think, or a conditional rezone or something like that. But I recall there being developments that had occurred 20 years before I worked for the city of Redmond, and it was very challenging going back through the record to find that development agreement that that was created 20 years ago. I think that it's good to have the tool. The RCW allows us to do it. I would just caution our legislative body to not make it the norm, but to make it for very special circumstances. And that's certainly something that could be spelled out in regulations.
Right. Absolutely. And the mayor's exactly right. They can be dangerous things, too, where you give someone vesting. And I've been part of things where it gives someone vesting for like 15 years, over 15 years, to a project. And is that exact code going to be stored in perpetuity for that entire time, or are you get someone going to throw it away because now you just transferred out all your staff and nobody remembers what happened anymore?
Yep.
If I may, I think back to the economic downturn where we watched a lot of development and then it just stopped. And if you had a development agreement, you'd have a vacant lot, which you really wouldn't know what the future of that particular lot is due to whatever finance the developer had at the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm hesitant. I think we should go forward and look into it, but so I don't have a problem with that. I think I'll have a lot more questions when we come to
it. Great, that's good. Councilmember Cutterback.
Yeah, I like the example you used about, putting in infrastructure and getting that done, and then once they start the other putting it in. I think that type of flexibility can really help a developer and get the job done. I do agree there's some challenges maybe with having a time limit or whatever's baked into the agreement to make sure nothing is sitting there for 20, 15 years and not having the code, the code will change during that time.
Right.
Having that vesting, but I do like having that flexibility to negotiate, especially some complicated projects, or to have the, I think that can work in the city's favor at times, and also the developers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll go ahead and keep that in the scope of work, unless there's objection from somebody. Nope. All right, so go ahead and move on to number 4.
Great. Residential zoning district. So this question was brought up because I've run into this in the past. Again, no right, no wrong. Should we establish minimum densities for residential zoning districts? And I bring this up because I ran into a situation where we had an R12, 12 units per acre. Two fairly well-off families came in and wanted to buy out a larger chunk of this R12 zone and just build two single-family residential homes in there. And so luckily our code prohibited that. It required in the 12, it required a minimum of 8 units, but they would have essentially had 2 homes in an area that could have supported, roughly 24 units. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of an eye-opening thing. I never thought it would happen until somebody actually made application to try to do this. And so that was kind of an eye-opening thing that, hey, we could have lost 24 lots out of our, our billable lands and what we're trying to build out at this density. And it's always stuck in the back of my head, and I was thankful that the code had that minimum, the minimum density requirements. So talking with Planning Commission, they were in some areas, like in the lower density, they said, no, we don't need that. We should allow people to have some flexibility to, instead of 4 units per acre, if they just want to do 2 and do some measure lots. However, once we get into the infill development, the higher density, we should look at setting some minimum lot size requirements, because if we really want density in those areas, we should be ensuring that those developers are developing at a minimum density in those areas. So that was the Planning Commission feedback on that.
Sounds good. Council, does anybody object to the Planning Commission's direction on this? And that direction would be to establish minimum residential density in some areas. Okay. I don't see any objection.
I agree.
Sounds good. So no objection, I've got agreement to proceed with that in the scope of work. Quick question for you, does this include the use of shadow lots? So like if you had somebody that all they wanted to do was a short plat, they had a larger piece of land, the idea being that you might do 9 lots today, but you had to demonstrate where the other, how you were going to develop the rest of the property to the density. Is that something that's still being used?
No.
Okay.
No, it's not. That's a good...
Okay, I would ask that as part of the scope of work that we look at tools where you might have a builder or developer that might have 5 acres, but their financial resources today might be only to develop half of that. I'm sorry about bringing up Redmond again, but when I was at Redmond, there was a tool there that allowed for what they called, it was literally called shadow lots, and they would record a final plat that included in heavy, you know, in solid line, the plat, and then in dashed line or faded line, they would then include the shadow lots where the future lots would go. And then if they came in to convert it from a short plat to a long plat, they had already done part of the work, and they would just finalize those lot lines and then be able to get the capital they needed from half the project to develop the rest of it. Usually that happened like 3 to 5 years later. But
okay. No, definitely.
If that's a tool that we're allowed to use, I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. So 4B, staff question, go ahead.
Open space requirement, or open space, and the key word here is usable open space. Mm-hmm. The question was the Planning Commission and saying the council is, would you like us in the new code to require a minimum percentage of open space for multifamily developments and plats? Some jurisdictions require 10% of the plat to be built out as usable open space, and that typically includes some minimum slope requirement. So you're not, you know, saying this is my open space and you're on a 40% slope. And then typically some type of amenity, whether it be a basketball court or a playground or something like that goes along with it. That's the percentage wise isn't the same, but that's generally what goes on in PRDs right now. Is they require some type of recreational element. When you get like main view homes, because they did so many land use actions all together, they offer a variety. So they have tot lots and they have basketball courts and everything kind of in their own complex. But it's something, you know, we can refine later. But then the general question is, should we pursue open space, mandatory open space requirements for plats and multifamily developments?
Thank you. Councilmember Kent.
Thank you. Is that a requirement then?
For PRDs it is. For street plats it's not.
Okay. The only concern I have is I know there are several areas where they put in an amenity, some small playground or something, which through disuse, lack of repair, become eyesores, and eventually we get requested by the neighbors to take it over and maintain it as a city property, which we can't do, really. We just can't afford it. So I'm kind of hesitant to go down that road of making it a requirement.
So one of the things that we might be able to do is like take a look at the number of lots also. So go ahead and contrast the Foothills or the farm at Woods Creek. You've got a couple hundred homes in the Foothills. We maintain all of our parks there. The farm at Woods Creek, you've got a few hundred homes. And I think does the city maintain the parks in the farm at Woods Creek? Or?
The upper one.
Okay. So there may be something where there's a threshold that could be part of the scope of work, where if it's 20 or fewer homes and they're actually clustering the lots, so they're doing smaller lot sizes, so there's less of a yard where we might require the open space, but maybe a standard subdivision with larger lots and fewer lots, maybe there's some sort of threshold that can be looked at as part of the scope. Because I hear exactly what Councilmember Camp is mentioning. You do have, just in the Frylands, there are some pocket parks that were required as part of PRDs that they're just not being maintained.
Right.
And Councilmember Camp is right. They then look at us to take it over.
Right.
And it seems like there must be a threshold of size and then the nexus of when it's required. But
yes, yeah.
Councilmember Cutterback.
No, I was going to say that too. Just the amount of size and
because we haven't taken, so do most developers now have, do they set up like a homeowners association that's required then to manage and take care of that open space usually within dues?
Yeah, and that was one, that'd be one thing I'd include in the plat code is the requirement for the HOA. Not to say that those are a catch-all because they can always dissolve, but typically when you have that momentum, and especially there was a good point about the larger developments, they maintain some sort of momentum. When you get down into those, you know, the lower or smaller ones, you know, people, the HOA may be around, but nobody pays attention to it or it just gets dissolved. But yeah, a threshold requirement. It could be, like typically for a multifamily development, you'll set aside like 100 square feet per unit or 140 feet. And that's typically just a green space for those people to go out and, you know, maybe you require some benches or something, just an outdoor seating area or a plaza area. And there's several different ways you can do. It doesn't have to be green grass. It can be a plaza. It just has to be something usable that you can write into code. But I do understand the point about the unintended consequences of these little parks that everybody just forgets about.
Yeah, I like the concept of requiring it because I think it can change the look, character, feel of a community and the aesthetics. But I also understand and agree that something needs to be put in place to make sure that things are maintained.
So we'll go ahead and, unless there's objection from another council member, we'll keep it in the scope of work. And I think you've got some feedback on different thresholds and different concerns that might weave its way into the scope of work, or at least conversations with a selected consultant. Okay. So we'll go ahead and move on to, that was 4A, 4B. Are you on 5 now?
Yeah, we're on 5.
5 design standards.
And so this is a big one. Currently, PRDs do require a level of design guidelines that go along with the houses. And so the question here is, do we want to have a set of design guidelines for residential development? And if the answer is yes, do you want those low, medium, high? The same thing I'll say to you is I said to Planning Commission that I cautioned against the high design standards because you had these unintended consequences of now you just turned it into what you're trying to get away from. You have such stringent design guidelines that everybody's building the same house, the same thing you're just trying to get away from.
Yeah.
And so if you go way beyond on the other side, it could put you in a bad spot. But Planning Commission, they did like the residential design guidelines to go along with it, and so they fell somewhere in between medium. It was a low medium. It essentially, they liked what we have right now in the PRD code, and you're essentially looking at, you know, the wrapping around the windows. Window treatments, a minimum porch size for something out front. You essentially do the facade treatments on the sides that are fronting public right-of-ways, not necessarily the areas in the back. So if you're on the corner lot, then, you know, things like belly bands, the strips around the house. These are minor things that go on right now in the current PRD code. I haven't heard much, you know, kickback from developers about them, but it's not. The other thing is, so you don't have someone coming in putting the exact same house next to each other, require separation and variation in form and styles for houses coming out.
Any thoughts from council? The Planning Commission recommendation is medium design standards should be drafted, and again, you'd have the opportunity to review the draft and whatnot. Councilmember Scarborough?
It says medium design standards. Would the city be the entity that determines what medium is?
And we would work through that as we went through the developing the code. I just wanted, you know, some sense of, no, absolutely, we have no interest in design standards. Or, well, maybe, you know, a few things. It was when I was in Duval, they actually, because every community kind of develops their own feel, they developed something called the trick or treat test, and it was Planning Commission that developed this. And what it was is they said, when I pull up in front of a house and I drop my child off and they go to that front door, I want to be able to see them from the time they leave my car all the way to the time they hit that front door. And what they were saying is they didn't like the, you know, like the heavily recessed front entrances to homes where it's off to the side. They wanted those front entrances prominent there, and they also had restrictions on how big the garage door could be compared, because they wanted the house to show more so than the garage, and setbacks of the garage from the front door, various things like that. I mean, there's multiple different tools. It's going to be something that, you know, we'll develop and feel out as we go through the process. But I was just generally gauging it for how we should approach it. And it can go either way. You know, maybe we start falling towards the low side or it gets towards the high side. I mean, it's just, should we move forward with this, and just a general estimate on what we're looking at.
So I'm not hearing objection to medium. Oh, Councilmember Cutback.
Well, does it get complicated for developers or builders, or is it?
It
sounds like it could.
It could, absolutely.
Okay.
It could. It could very quickly.
Yeah.
And so this is something that we would have to. In design guidelines, they're good and they're bad because of that. It is something we have to be very cautious with as we move forward.
Well, it seems like some of the builders that have come in recently, I mean, it seems like they follow that, where they're not building the same house next to each other, because they know that doesn't sell. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would think builders would want some sort of a design. They're already doing it somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
For the very reason of to be able to sell the properties.
Absolutely, and that has changed, especially now that you have some of these larger builders in town.
Yeah.
And even with the smaller builders, they were doing it. It's just that you get the ones that sometimes come in, and I think the good thing about design guidelines is that I think some builders, as long as you don't go too overboard, the builders like is it provides some level of assurance.
Yeah.
Because if I just, you know, spend a lot of money on a development and then somebody comes in and is trying to piggyback it and do minimum necessary and now they're making my development look bad. And so this would be establishing those minimum thresholds. But you're exactly right. A lot of those builders up there right now are meeting the standards
yeah.
that we would kind of shoot for with
yeah.
this medium.
Well, and that's why I brought that up. Just if it's kind of already happening in practice,
mm-hmm.
then it makes sense that we use that. And I think we just have to be careful about making it too complicated.
Absolutely. That's
just my thoughts.
Okay. So it sounds like there's consensus to at least leave it in for now. No objection to continuing with that on the scope. And Councilmember Cutback, one of the things that I want to see is something that's simple to implement also. I don't want something that's so complicated that somebody opens it and doesn't understand what the requirements are. What's that?
Sure, anything at Redmond?
Anything at Redmond? Oh, I don't know today. No. Thank you.
Yeah, the goal of it is it's something that staff would administer and staff would review. We wouldn't have to pull in an architect to understand our own,
right.
own guidelines.
Some of that stuff got complicated. It wasn't all unicorns there. All right, the next item, design standards. 5B, should multifamily residential development be subject to design standards?
So with multifamily, Planning Commission responded to this, and their biggest concern was we don't want large blank walls. If someone comes in and builds an apartment complex, I mean, you can see some of the developments that have been done down there, and they look nice. I mean, that's what, if I had to write the multifamily design standards, I'd probably go down and go off a lot of those developments. I mean, they went a little bit extra on it, as opposed to we're just building this giant box. There's no articulation. There's nothing interesting about it. And that's what Planning Commission was really concerned about, is we don't want somebody just coming in and having this large blank wall. So they said medium, we want some articulation to the actual structure, like you see down at the Housing Hope places. They did a great job in orienting entrances towards the street, those kind of things. And so that was their big thing they included with the multifamily.
Any objection to having design standards, medium level design standards for single family residential development? Okay, no objection. Go ahead and move on to 5C, commercial development.
So commercial development, same thing, design standards. Planning Commission came back with a recommendation for some medium design standards. And the question kind of came down to is, you know, Monroe has some different areas in it. You know, you got the highway tour, and you have the main street up here, you have the downtown area. If you want design standards for everything, you know, some places may lend it to more because it has a character that kind of flows and you can write standards around it. And so so they looked at looking at areas, and if you'll see down, and I'm kind of drifting down into D here also, is yes, they wanted design standards, and you should draft them, and looking at, you know, downtown commercial, and then near Highway 2 and then North Kelsey area too. So they wanted to go into, I guess, general design standard to go with a neighborhood feel around it. So I thought going into this, because right now we have commercial design standards under this section of Main Street right here. When council adopted that code, it came with its own set of design standards. Downtown came with its own set of design standards. That is about it, I think, for the city. And so, just, do you want to keep it in kind of these areas with their own standards? Do you want a large standard? Are you interested in proceeding with standards, design standards for commercial? And so council's recommendation was a medium.
Okay, so Planning Commission's recommendation.
Planning Commission's recommendation.
And so we'll go ahead and we can handle the two questions together since you introduced them like that. So we'll go ahead and call on Councilmember Cutaback and then Councilmember Camp. Councilmember Cutaback.
So the downtown plan, it seemed like it had four neighborhoods. It seemed like we had very specific design standards. That was one of the problems that came up with the Kelsey plan. It wasn't as specific. Mm-hmm. And the downtown plan in the four areas, don't we already have those for down in those four areas?
We do. And so with this code amendment, we're pulling everything back. And so, you know, when we come back and bring in some new code, and like I said, I'm actually bringing you the downtown regulations next week, I think. Okay. And so these regulations that we've already touched will probably keep largely intact because we've already just gone through
right.
it. It's not like they're old and outdated. But when we come back with it, is that something we want to continue with? Because we're really trying to take that fresh look at everything when we go through this process.
Okay.
And then, you know, do we want to, you know, kind of roll them into a larger set of design guidelines, and we find kind of keeping those separate. So that's what I was looking at. And then, and then along West Main here too.
So I guess off the cuff, I mean, I would be in favor of keeping some certain standards for the downtown core, because Main Street and downtown, that's the hub of it can be the hub of our community, and I think can give distinct characteristics from different areas throughout our community. So I'd be in favor of yes, having standards for the downtown commercial and different areas in, you know, North Kelsey also.
Okay.
So.
Sounds good. Councilmember Kim.
Thank you. I was on the Planning Commission when we worked on Main Street.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm
still here. If I remember correctly, the look and feel, what we're aiming for with Main Street was more of a small shop, apartment complex kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we went a little bit higher in terms of the standards. We also had, I remember, long conversations about drive-throughs
yes.
on Main Street mm-hmm. and how they needed to be recessed and all that. I'm not quite sure. If your question is, do we want to have a blanket requirement for the whole city? No, I want it specified for each area, like
yeah.
you mentioned. Downtown, Main Street, Kelsey. Things closer to Highway 2 are probably going to be more commercial than things mm-hmm. further out here. But for commercial, I know we're kind of playing a game or a that's kind of fast and loose with this. I would expect whatever we come up with for standards for housing, I'd like it a higher standard for commercial because that really handles the look and feel for the city. I want to do everything I can to get away from the strip mall concept, which is what the housing or the equivalent of a box housing. So that would be the direction I want to go on that.
Is there objection to going for a medium high then on the commercial?
You know, it depends on what we're defining. If the way the Main Street is currently defined, if that would be medium high, I'd be fine with it. if it's medium okay, whatever the ultimate definition comes out to be. But I just think it needs to be higher relative to our housing.
Perfect.
Commercial should just be at a higher level.
Got it. Okay.
Councilmember Gamble?
Yeah, I think a medium commercial is the definition of medium residential, so
okay.
I'm fine with bringing back medium and commercial, and let's review what that looks like. I just think it's inherent in it's a commercial, so I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. I'm just saying that the scale for me is, you know, and I still don't want to get too...
Well, you go too
prescriptive, and then you lose out on, you know,
innovation.
Well, not only innovation, but you may lose out on a business and even locating here. That's happened to us before as well. So I agree with what you're saying, but I think that medium business just carries a certain, you know, length with that, and pretty specific on the different areas, you know, the core of the downtown, the North Kelsey area, and we just customize it to that. So.
Sounds good. So what I'm hearing is a consensus then for medium. I'm also hearing consensus for having the standards be different. I'm not saying high, medium, low, but just the standards may be different. Treatment for example, the downtown versus Highway 2.
If I could just...
Oh, sorry, Councilmember Camp.
Thanks. I just want to add on to
the
point, because I remember how much work we spent on the graduates, because that was the real crux for everything on Main Street, and making sure that it didn't look like we had a Starbucks every 20 feet or something. Mm-hmm. So that's my interest in terms of having a higher standards for commercial.
Yeah.
So, that was it.
Great.
Thank you. All right, go ahead and move on to E. Should these regulate wall height or materials?
Okay, so
materials.
So this is something that the city will be running into and is already running into, and I know has been an issue in past jurisdictions, and just as much as we can, I know a lot of the plats already invested, is to get out ahead of this if it is a concern. So as we move up the hill, you have more topography, you're going to have bigger walls. Some of the proposed walls right now are a little over 20 feet in some of the areas, and some of them are, you know, tiered back, and so you have 20 feet here, and then you may go back up, you know, 20 feet, and there's another 10-foot wall. I know some jurisdictions are really frown on that and really want you to, you know, as much as possible. It's much more difficult than it sounds as far as using existing topography. A lot of the times that doesn't work, especially when you have, I know I've been in places where we had conflicting standards where we said we want usable area and we don't want anything more than 5% slope, but use existing topography when you're, you know, doing your plat. Well, you can't do both of those things without doing, you know, a certain amount of grading. And so so with this, we posted to Planning Commission, and so Their big thing was just the materials. We don't want giant ecology block walls. We don't want something that, you know, looks ugly. That what they're doing right now, and a lot of consultants are doing, or consultants, a lot of developers are doing themselves, is what's called lock and load, which is, has a nice texture to it. Yeah.
Okay.
And then you know, various things that I had a past council member who said this kind of sarcastically, called it zoo rock. It's a concrete that looks like, you know, makes it look like rock, but, you know, still looks nice. So Planning Commission, I think they're more concerned, but they did want to review some nice stuff. More concern was just about the aesthetics of the wall. They didn't want just those ecology blocks. Like when you're in the driving through to Costco in Woodinville and you look up on the hill and you see the giant wall of ecology blocks, they didn't want anything like that. So.
And just to give you a little bit of background on this also, I've received a couple comments from people about some of the wall heights that have been developed around town. An example is over at Evergreen Heights going up Roosevelt. There's a pretty tall wall that is holding up a lot. About how, Brad, do you know about how tall that wall is?
Only 15.
How much?
About 15.
About 15 feet. Yeah. So, you know, there are different things that developers can do with those walls. Or to reduce the likelihood that they're going to have walls. One is they can build a different product. So if you have a daylight basement or something, then what happens is that the transition can occur over the course of the lot rather than
at the edges of the lot. So daylight basements are one way to handle that. Another way to handle that is when you do have to have a taller wall, putting in landscaping and things like that in front of the wall so that you don't have a big mass of essentially concrete, whether it is zoo rock or ecology block, but something that gathers a lot of heat and it is not something that is really pedestrian friendly to walk along. And then So these are some of the things that I see, and I do see that the Planning Commission's direction is to look at regulating both wall height and materials. Mm. And so
heavy emphasis on materials.
On materials, okay. Yeah. So there are some things that can be encouraged to help reduce the wall height rather than just manufacturing lots, creating lots out of air, just piling dirt and compacting it and putting it behind the wall. All right, Councilor Scarborough, do you have a comment? Or
you answered in the last. I thought you put a emphasis on materials, and I saw that the recommendation from the Planning Commission was wall height and materials. So I just was asking for a clarification, and you did.
Okay. All right, so I'm not hearing objection then to the Planning Commission's direction. All right. Do you have anything else that you wanted to go over?
That is it. Thank you very much.
Councilmembers, do you have anything else that you expect out of the development regulations? One of the big things that I want to see out of the development regulations, and I said it earlier, is something that is internally consistent. That means it doesn't contradict itself. But I also want something that is simple to read and simple to understand. So I would like to make certain that the scope of work reflects that. I would also like to make certain that the scope of work looks at different tools that can be used to help convey what it is that we're looking for in development. I know that some regulations that I've seen actually have drawings do this, but not this. I don't know, because I've been out of planning for over a decade, well over a decade now, I don't know what sort of tools exist today, but I'd like to have matrices or just simple language to help keep it simple. So that's a big selling point that I'm looking for also in regulations.
Absolutely.
All right, Council, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
You're welcome. And again, please thank our Planning Commission for their work on this. All right, we're going to go ahead and move now to council member reports. City Legislative Affairs Committee was canceled this evening. Snohomish County tomorrow Steering Committee. Councilmember Scarborough.
When did this meeting about last week or so? You were out of town. And I think the crux of the meeting was, and I shared it with Dan, and because it sounded like they needed a decision on whether we were going to be willing to pay more dues or not that Friday. And I handed it over to Ben, and he got clarification from Ms. Pruitt that there was more time. But the crux was, is I believe we pay about 2.5% right now. They wanted to go to a total of another 13% or 15.5% for 2 years, at which point it can go down to, I believe it was about 6% 1 year. 13% more for 2018 and 19, and then the rates could be reduced in 2021. In 2020, 6%, 2021, 4.5%, 2022, 3%. And then they had basically a list of things that the steering committee says they want to accomplish, and they need the money in order to accomplish it or do. It's on page 13 of that thing. And it says what the money would go for or where they would be with the money and using up their reserve fund. And so I don't, if she was asking me for an answer at the meeting, she wasn't going to get it because that's not my decision. But I did bring it back. Ben's got it, and I don't know if he shared it with you, but you might want to look into what the Snohomish County tomorrow's committee wants from us to be part of that committee, because it is a dues committee. We pay to begin it.
So Councilmember Scarborough, what we'll do then is somebody from staff will send a letter to Snohomish County tomorrow and request additional information. Specifically, what we need from them is a letter identifying what it is they are looking for. And
a lot of that information is in the thing I gave Ben. So
perfect. Okay.
And some of the people at the meeting said, well, what would it look like if we just wanted 1, 3, 8, and 10? Could you get by with another 2%, something like to that effect? So if we have input to that, that might be where it is.
So what we'll do is we'll go ahead and queue that up for staff to look into, and then we'll bring it back to council. At the end of the day, it's going to be a budgetary decision of our city council to make an adjustment. It sounds like current year, they want more money this current year, or are we talking about beginning January 1st of 2018?
I think it's pretty darn quick, because that was the, we got a number right away.
Well, staff will go ahead and follow up then, council member.
Okay, a couple of other things they discussed. They pointed out between 2005 and 2015 that 96,000 more people moved into Snohomish County, 156,000 more cars. And they wanted everybody to know that the shoulder lane on Highway 405 started, and it was a success. Whatever that means.
So they used a shoulder lane on 405. You know, we've got shoulder lanes on 522 also.
Right.
That's good to know.
But they just started these openings on 405.
Yep. Up to Everett from Boston.
They expect 20 million more people between now and 2040. Hence, the 2040 plan is under. They want to know what the city's input is for the 2040 plan. So that was in my notes on the front page. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah. Staff will take a look at that too.
So this, I guess that's something that needs to be reviewed. That's about it. This was the biggie.
So what we'll do then is staff will take a look at the 2040. This is one of those things that, even though, I mean, it's a long ways off, I'll be 70. So we want to make certain that we are commenting on those. Otherwise, what happens is decisions end up getting made. We don't get funding for 522 and so on and so forth. So staff will look into that, and we'll follow back up with you in an upcoming council meeting. And as necessary, we'll put together written comments and send them in. So thank you very much, Councilmember. Any questions for Councilmember Scarborough on SCT? All right, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on to the next council report. Community Transit Board of Directors, Councilmember Colbeck.
I had a work conflict, a corporate finance meeting at the same time, so I was unable to attend.
Okay. Thank you. Snohomish Health District, Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. Back to last Friday, had an executive meeting. Much of the conversation was just kind of reviewing the retreat that we had previously, and conversations are still going on about continuous improvement in our governance, and more conversations on the finance aspect. We had a big discussion on the possibility of the government shutdown, how that would affect. Fortunately, that didn't take place, so we run it as usual. Today's meeting with the general board, I had called in on that, and pretty uneventful, I guess you could say. A couple big items. Listened to a discussion of proposal from Enterprise Rent-A-Car to discuss taking over the health district's fleet, which it was hard to follow being on the phone and trying to go through the information, but potential cost savings there. I'm actually meeting with the interim administrator, our director, Jeff Getchell, on Friday and have coffee with him and get some more clarity on that, amongst other things as well. The search for the health officer continues. The HR committee and staff interviewed one candidate last week, said it went very well. They're trying to set up an interview with another candidate who's unfortunately out of the country right now, so they're trying to do it remotely. And then hopefully those are two candidates that they can choose from because we need a health officer. So, outside of that, the rest of the meeting was devoted to our annual awards from the health district, awarding businesses a variety of different fields. Unfortunately, none from our community made it this year, but it's good to know that we have some good businesses out there.
All right, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and go on down the line now. Then for Councilmember reports, Councilmember Gamble.
Well, just one personal note, since the last time we were together, there is a new DM driver on the road, so Chief Quinzer, please alert all staff.
He's a good driver.
He's probably a better driver than you.
Yeah.
More good news.
Yeah. No, probably is. Oh, no, just happy Mother's Day.
Councilmember Kim.
Councilmember Kim.
Thank you.
Yes. Enjoy your holiday. Oh. Old wise man. Yeah, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers, and for those of us whose mothers have gone on to their reward. Thanks, Mom. It's been great. I attended the Monroe Alex Council executive session last night. They have a lot of activities coming up. It should be interesting. I have a question about Saturday's dump thing.
Oh, that's right.
So, okay, so we're allowed... Our neighborhood makes it into a community event. If I'm putting you on the spot, I apologize.
No, that's okay.
Okay, so our neighbor, you know, like one or two of us have access to a truck. And so we kind of go, I'll take mine up and then I'll go to the neighbor and load up the truck. Can we use the other person's access sheet in order to take the load up? Or is it just one?
I understand it was set up, and of course this was all determined before I got here, so I'm just working
off. Oh, I'm not pointing at you, so
just... No. I'm just saying, I'm working off the information that I have tried to glean since then.
Gotcha.
And it's my understanding that they are trying to manage the size of the cleanup, and so the intent is that by sending the flyers in the utility bills, and it says on the flyers, no photocopies will be taken. It's meant to be residential, one trip per residence.
Okay.
You know, and then you get your shot, you know, whether it's in the back of your pickup or, you know, in former lives I've seen them come in their nice car where they just build up their trunk, depending on what it is they are dumping. It's supposed to be a one shot. So I think, I would imagine, and I can certainly call Republic tomorrow to find out for sure for you, that it's a neighborhood effort that you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and that you're all contributing, you know, if you've got five flyers but one truck to use, as long as you get there before it closes, I can't imagine it get turned away.
If you could check on that. Like I said, I know that other neighborhoods do the same thing, where they have one person. When my mother-in-law lived up in the farm, I helped her neighborhood as well by loading up the truck and hauling them up there. So, yeah, okay. If you can find out, let us know.
I will.
That's all good. Thank you.
Yes. And so, Ms. Hasser, will you go ahead and send an email to council to clarify?
Perfect.
Thank you. All right, Councilmember Davis.
Tonight.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. Since we met last, I had the opportunity to be a judge at the Monroe Lip Sync contest. That was incredible. Some amazing talent out there. And it was just a ton of fun. So very, very pleased that I had that opportunity. Attended the chamber meeting today. Mayor Thomas speaking, given the State of the City address, which was good to hear. Earlier today, I had the opportunity to join Mike Farrell in attending the Snohomish County meeting, where they awarded the small capital projects grants to cities, and thanks to a partnership between the Boys and Girls Club and the Monroe Parks, our grant request was fulfilled or granted to bring trailside exercise equipment down to Sky River Park. So that will be coming down there very shortly. It's just a one of those great opportunities where organizations, city, Boys and Girls Club, the county just come together and for the benefit of the youth and the community and for better health and just giving more options out there. So we're very, very pleased to get that and speak to the council on that. And Mike, thank you for your work and Dale's work on that. So it was awesome.
That's all I have. Thank
you. Councilmember
Kovac. Nothing tonight. Thank you. Councilmember
Scarborough. Thank you. The lights downtown look really nice. I think they have an added value. Not much else to report tonight.
Thank you. We're going to go ahead on to staff. The first one is a police update. And is that Deputy Chief Conner?
Thank you, Mayor and Council. First thing I'd like to do is wish all the mothers a happy Mother's Day. And then we'll talk about homeless encampments. With the addition of the police side-by-side and the help of the Parks Department, we've been able to consistently monitor the woods up behind Walmart and the DOT properties, as well as all of our city properties. As of now, we have no new camps in any of those locations, so that's good news there. Since the addition of our social worker, Alyssa Delgado, we've made 18 contacts with folks out in our community, some of them being the same clients. These weekly contacts have allowed us to build trust with some of the community, and we are currently involved in providing services to four individuals that previously didn't want to talk to the police department, so that's good news. Body cameras, we've issued five of our officers here in the last week, so they're out in the field. Our Lexapol is our department policy manual. We have that completed in electronic version, and we've given it to the officers and asked them to complete reading through it and initialing that they run through it and understand it by July 31st, where it'll go into implementation in full in August 1st. We have a copy with the cop coming up. This is a national program that brings law enforcement and the community together. And it's a meet and greet to discuss local issues. We're going to be hosting the first one at Sahara Pizza at 10 o'clock on the 16th of May. A couple other things, bronze award winners. The department was awarded bronze level for Special Olympics Circle of Honor and the fundraisers that they conducted in 2016, which was tip of top with Adam's Bistro, Red Robin, and the event we put on out at Wings and Wheels at First Airfield. And then the last is just a couple of high notes for the officers keeping involved and in physically good shape. Sergeant Brian Johnston and Officer Daryl Stamey finished the Fun with the Fuzz 5K up in Bellingham. And that was a very successful event. And Officer Adam Wolf, Craig Robertson, and Community Service Officer Gabby Escalante completed the Spartans on here in town. So it was very successful, and they enjoyed themselves. Other than that, we're just running business as usual. It's been a productive month, but somewhat quiet. No special cases to talk to you about.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Any questions for Deputy Chief?
What do you think is going to happen now that McDonald's is closed?
You know, it's
going to be a new congregation area somewhere else?
It possibly will be. You know, we see them congregating at the 7-Eleven on Main Street. What we have been doing with the encampments and the homeless people is we've been taking them to McDonald's and giving them a hamburger. That's going to present somewhat of an issue for us when it closes down for the remodel. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Any other questions for the chief? Councilmember Campbell.
It was nice to end up on the Tonight Show for a month. It was good. I appreciate that.
That was great. Okay. Anything further? Thank you, Deputy Chief. All right, the next presentation we have from staff this evening is from our Public Works Department, Mr. Hauber.
I'm just not going to be PowerPoints or anything. So, sorry. The report's in your packet. We're still working on all our projects that we've got going. A couple things to note is one that the overlay projects that we're having done with the county came in 30% higher than estimates, and actually we've heard from other cities that most construction projects this season are about 30% higher than anticipated, so we may have to modify this slightly to get the project, not be able to do all the projects we thought we were doing originally. And then also you heard your call that we talked about the chain link road closure, which is coming up on Monday, and we have had that on Facebook. If you guys opened your water bill, went out recently, was it there? Set up our usual news flash that goes out through the website for all the people who receive newsletters about that. Set up a media release to the press. And also the contractor sent out notice to the people who are immediately adjacent to it, you know, to how to contact them and coordinate, you know, when can I get out of my driveway, when can I can't get out of my driveway when the large backhoe there is in front of them. So hopefully that will all go smooth.
And message signs as well.
And yes, and then there's also the column of the road itself. There's the variable message signs that have been up there since the last Friday of April. So hopefully most of the people have driven by them a few times and will remember on Monday that they should make a left before they get there. So, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Councilmember Scarborough.
I want to refer to the email from Mr. Nye. Have you read his?
No. I forwarded that to our administrator.
It's pretty, that. Pretty long, and I would consider it.
Only?
Yeah.
Okay, I was thinking that related to the construction project. No. That's the Brown Road one, yes.
Correct.
Okay. Yes.
So with his comments on here, is there any thought in changing the hours and making more days so that the hours are more like 9 to 3 after peak traffic out, peak traffic come home because comes after the closure? Because, and or, I mean, what's the effect of that to help people out? What would the effect of going 9 to 3 do to the project?
It would make it take a lot longer because basically they could get very little work done because of the amount of time to set up and take down. So it basically, you know, increases exponentially because they want to get very much work done.
I have some sympathy for Mr. Nye's comments. You know, we're putting all the people that live here at disadvantage so we can have contractors make more money and build more houses. So, you know, I can understand. You read his email, I have some sympathy for his comments, and I wish we could do something to speak to those issues. Commented it just take more time. Somebody would say, okay, so what? I don't know that I'm saying that. I'm just saying, what is the effect of it taking more time on that project? Does that cost the city money? Does that cost the contractor? I'm sitting imaginary, it only costs the contractor.
Cost contract money, cost the city money. Well, the city staff would be out there longer, so, you know, other things would have to be pushed out, things like that.
Okay. I'm just making my points, and I think Mr. Nye has made some points that we at least answer his letter about why we can't accommodate his comments. And the comments are more than just the road being blocked. The comments are about infrastructure in Monroe, and we're building all of these houses, and we still only have about 3 arterials that come down the hill to hit Highway 2 to go out of town. So his point was, fix the arterials before you keep building houses and putting cars on the roads to plug them up. So his frustration is twofold. It's that, and it's going to have a little bit of time.
Mr. Mosley.
Uh, We can certainly draft a response, which I'd be happy to sign for the letter.
I just think it should be responded.
Sure, I mean that's we can certainly do that.
There he likes the answer.
Well, that's correct. But he deserves a response, and I'd be happy to do that. I would point out that originally the developer's request was to close the chain link road for 28 days.
Yeah.
And so this is a pretty significant, and we said no. You're not going to change. You're not going to close this major arterial for 28 days. And so then we engaged in some discussion, Brad did, with the developer that got it down to basically 10 days. And they also wanted to close it between like 6 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock at night so that they could. And we've got that reduced to a shorter period of time. But those are the kinds of things we could explain to him in the letter. That
they might help smooth the stuff.
Right, and we'd be happy to do that.
Yeah. And as far as the transportation and whatnot, that's one of the reasons why we had the community meeting about 191st. We're working at trying to identify ways to fund infrastructure as development occurs. It's one of the reasons why we collect impact fees from development. One of the reasons why it's important to have development that's in our urban growth area be actually within the city limits, so that we can realize both the one-time construction sales tax and also the real estate excise tax that allows us those one-time big bursts of money to be able to fund our transportation infrastructure here in the city limits. So we are being proactive about those sorts of things. I requested that we do the community meeting on 191st back in the late fall when I realized, and I realize isn't the right word, when as we saw all of these plats, all of these lots coming in you know, on either side of Chain Lake, it became even more apparent that it was important to start the process for reestablishing 191st. And we are being very proactive as a city to be with development as opposed to 10 years behind development, which many cities will do. Many cities will take that one-time construction sales tax, they'll just factor it into their operating expenses. These are things that we're not doing. Many cities may look at a new development that's proposed in an urban growth area where, unfortunately, we're expecting sewer to, and say, no, that's okay. We're working with that particular developer to try to bring them into city limits. So, these are things that we're trying to do to make certain that we watch out for our infrastructure. Did you have anything further?
No.
Okay, Councilmember Gamble, did you have anything further, Councilmember?
No, thank you.
No, I was just going to add that, you know, from a response, I responded to him. I mean, there's no reason why any one of us can't respond to him. But what I would throw is, I was going to say exactly that, is that staff, really went to try to mitigate the impact to citizens by making it, putting it in the window of, around commute times, peak commute times, getting it, the request reduced. And then what I would say further is that we spent, a good 15 minutes or so debating it in council and open session and asking questions around, hey, can it be done at night? What's the night? And then realizing, oh, that's right, we have a night ordinance, or we have a sound deal at 10, and we would add alter that in order to overcome that. So I think there's that due diligence, but the larger context of his email was more in regards to your point, was more about growth and traffic, and that's where I invite the discussion, because this is not, I've been getting a lot of this input from even friends coming directly at me, and the discussion that I've had is that, look, growth is not a linear progression. It's not just, hey, we can't do this until this happens. It's swim lanes. It's a total picture that we have to be looking at, and you have to be working in all different areas, whether it's in public works, roads and transportation. That's why we have all these different plans. And a lot of times, maybe this isn't the response, people don't even know those exist. They don't understand that, okay, we've got a transportation benefit district, we've got a roads project, we've got a lobbyist, and we've got a lot of work going through that we're all behind, and we sign and we go down for days down in Olympia to support getting that $700,000 moved up for engineering and design. So I think there's a complex is a comprehensive response that really looks at, hey, these are all the areas we're going, and it's not a linear, growth is not a linear progression. It's a swim lane, you know, type issue. So it's never going to be, well, hey, we're just going to deny until, well, first, that's, you can't do that. But, you know, that's just not how growth works. So that was my view. I'd love to discuss it with anybody.
Okay. All right, so staff will go ahead and draft a letter. David, thank you very much for doing that. And then we'll get that out to him in the next couple of days.
Well, I'm not going to be here, but so it'll take a little bit longer than that.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Mosley. All right, anything further from Public Works?
No.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll just go ahead and put it through staff and back. Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Mayor, the council. So the parks, rec events brochure, got that printed up and they've been mailed out from the community. And also they'll be going to visitor centers in the area as well. So we're excited to have that done. To move off of Councilman Member Rasmussen's mention about being awarded that small capital grant. So what that will cover is the cost of the equipment and supplies for the installation of four exercise stations at Skyward Park. So then the city labor is matched, and we're also working with the Boys and Girls Club too. And we're going to shoot for fall. It would be the time to install this. And so we're super excited about that. And then the other thing I want to update you on is that the playground installation is continuing to move along, and we're getting close to, as you can see when you're out there, nearing the end there. And so we are still on track for it to be finished by the end of this month. And we are working now on figuring out a date for a grand reopening dedication celebration. So that's to be determined, so stay tuned on that. I attended, we had a Parks and Rec booth at the YMCA's Healthy Kids Day last weekend, and really enjoyed that. Enjoyed chatting with lots of families in Monroe, so it's a great event for the community. And lastly, we have advertised for requests for proposals for master planning for the Ty Park and also Cabin site. Those proposals are due May 24th, so we're moving along on those as well.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Farrell? All right, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move. Mr. Swanson?
Yeah, just to follow up on Councilmember Scarborough's Sandwich County Tomorrow rate increase. So I called the county, and apparently someone at the county misspoke regarding the urgency of when we have to respond to them by. But I do have Sandwich County Tomorrow Planning Advisors Committee meeting this week, so I'll get additional detail then and be able to get back.
Okay.
Appropriate answer.
Perfect, thank you. And you'll also check into when the comments are due from the 24 division?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. My main goal is there.
Can I give you a date? Because I have May 14th. Comments are due 3rd. Yeah, that's what they put out. May 14th, which isn't that far away. For 24.
That's Thursday next week. Okay. Sunday?
Couldn't read my chicken scratch.
So staff will follow up on the deadline for that. Thank you. All right, anything further for Mr. Swanson?
No.
Okay. Anything further? All right. Ms. Hazard.
It was mentioned earlier, just a reminder about spring cleanup on Saturday, 9 to 1. At the high school. So again, don't forget your flyers because they won't take photocopies of those. So, and then we had a street banner that was up on Main Street to advertise it. However, it did not survive Thursday's storm. At this point, since it is this weekend, by the time we've got a new banner, there'd be no point in putting it up. But we feel like we have been pretty broad with advertising it, so that's why you don't see a street banner at the back at this point.
All right, thank you. Any questions from Ms. Hassert? All right, seeing none, Mr. Feilberg, do you have anything further?
No, thank you.
Okay. Ms. Atkinson, do you have anything? I know we have Snohomish County Cities next week. Do you have RSVPs from any council members?
I have one, okay. And that is Councilmember Scarborough. He is registered. It is buffet. If anyone wants to go, I don't need an entree order. I just need to know so I can register.
Okay. And if I remember correctly, the topic was the SNOCOM, SNOCAC, which the council members have already received a presentation on here. I won't be attending that myself. That would be my
first presentation.
I don't remember off the top of my head.
It's a week from this.
Yes, next Thursday.
Councilmember Scarborough, thank you for
thank
you. Representing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He likes the free meal.
Wow. Councilmember Scarborough, if you learn anything different from that meeting than the presentation here, we would appreciate it.
I was hoping somebody else would go with
me. Just make sure to show up on time. Show up late, Councilmember Camp goes, he might steal your meal.
I started.
All right. So let's go ahead and go to our city administrator.
The only announcement I have is I will be on vacation from tomorrow through Monday. Be back to the council meeting next Tuesday night. My wife and I are going out of town to celebrate my 70th birthday on May 13th. Thank you. Presents are gladly accepted. So it will take a couple extra more days to get that letter out, but I will get on that as soon as I get back.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. For me, I thank you all. Everything went along smoothly. Staff, thank you for all the work that you did over the last couple weeks while I was out. They went ahead and prepared the PowerPoint presentation for me for today's State of the City address. They did a great job, included speaking notes and everything. I went ahead and put together a speech for that. Presented that today over the course of about 25 minutes. And would encourage you to go ahead and take a look at the PowerPoint presentation. It'll go up online over the next couple days. We'll go ahead and put it on the Mayor Facebook page so you can link to it. The speech itself will be there also, and I probably hit about 90% of the words in there. Just, probably went a little bit off-road on it also. But again, the kernel of what I had to say was just things are going really well right now. We're being very careful, very wise with recognizing when something is one-time income versus ongoing revenue, and we're going to invest the one-time revenue into one-time expenditures like road projects and things like that, and that kind of thing. Talked a lot about how I appreciate the partnership and the leadership from the council members here, and the importance of us being involved regionally and whatnot. Talked a little bit about the SR 522 and $750,000 that was approved as part of the transportation budget for the practical design along the 522 corridor. Recognized that, it's not the $55 or the $110 million that's needed to complete one phase or the whole thing, but it's getting us one step closer, and it's step by step. When we weren't included in Connecting Washington, for us to be able to have $750,000 put aside to move the project forward, that's what I was looking for when we started the lobbying effort about a year and a half to 2 years ago, is look, let's not take away from the people that got in Connecting Washington, let's find a third way to make this work. And our lobbyists, the council, our legislators, our county council member, county executive, everybody's coming together to help make this to help move this along, and thank you all for that support in doing that. And enjoyed my vacation, went to South Utah, and encourage you all to go check it out sometime. I've got some amazing photos that some of you may have seen on Facebook, and thanks for your patience in looking over those many, many photos my wife and I put up. Councilmember Camp, congratulations on earning the Perfect Attendance Award.
Oh, thank you.
I saw that while I was on vacation. I'm like, right on. He's at every meeting, and I appreciate that.
I was hiding in the back when she made the announcement. A little bit shocked.
You're welcome. And then I understand that Sergeant Brian Johnson will be the parade.
Yes.
the grand marshal of the parade. So I heard that from Chief Flins earlier this evening, and congratulations to him on that. That's
we riding horses this year?
No horses, no. No Mustangs. You have Corvettes, no Mustangs. I might ride in a Mustang.
I'm riding a Mustang.
Oh, that's right. Two Mustangs.
Or you have a beat up Cavalier.
That was great.
2 years ago?
Yeah.
Last year.
So, thank you all. And we're going to go ahead and move over. Oh, and Councilmember Cutaback?
Yes.
Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. So let's go ahead and wrap things up.
Okay. No lobbyist report today because everything that's going on in Olympia is all budget negotiations behind the scenes. There's very little, if any, floor action, so no lobbyist report today. On the it says the draft agenda for the 26th, but it actually means the 16th. Oh, no, that would be the... Yeah. On the 16th, we have... three action items, the downtown commercial zone, which Ben mentioned earlier tonight, and then the downtown free waiver extension the council asked us to bring back. That will be on the agenda. And then the signing of the BNSF construction and maintenance agreement for the river crossing sidewalk project. And then there is the tentative P4 meeting, and so council members could get back to us on potential action items on that. Us meaning Liz. That would be very much appreciated.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. You produced three lights. Councilmember Cutaback.
Well, on the 16th, I will be at 7 o'clock at the high school attending a marimba concert. So,
are you giving?
That's where you're going to be?
Concert.
No, my daughter plays in marimba.
Oh,
in Holly Elementary. So I will be there. I don't know how long it lasts. Or
supposed to be done by 7:30.
Half hour concert?
6:30 to 7:30 is what I show.
So. So I might not make it, depending on how long it goes.
Okay. So we'll mark down Councilmember Cutaback as out, and of course you may show up. Right. And then Councilmember Gamble also had his light, same thing?
Yeah, apparently there's going to be a forum at the Marimba concert.
Is there really?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, okay.
Half a quorum. Half a quorum at the Marimba concert. It's their last one.
Okay. Okay, so we'll both mark you as...
Council meeting members going to have to set up a forum.
Okay, so we've
but
got...
I will come to the concert.
All right, sounds good. So we'll put down Councilmember Gamble and Councilmember Cutaback is out on May 16th, and of course we'll announce you when you come in for some meeting. Councilmember Rasmussen.
No Marimba concert on the 23rd, but I will be out for my son's concert that night.
Okay.
That's the 2-year-old.
All right, anything else for the agenda or the extended agenda? All right, do you have anything further, Mr. Mercer?
I know.
Okay, we have no other business for this evening. Councilmember Rasmussen?
To adjourn.
Sorry. I have a motion to adjourn from Councilmember Rasmussen, a second from Councilmember Davis. Any discussion on the motion to adjourn? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much. Have a great evening. Thank you for your service.
Right.
Bye. Mustang? Bye, Matt.
No.